That's awesome. I have a question. It's really great to see you, Dr. Sarah. We really miss you. Going to about more the equity that you work towards in the college that you work at, I was wondering if there's some sort of maybe not formal, or if it is formal, assessment of how you assess where they are at in terms of equity and diversity.
It's a really good question, and it's so good to see you. A lot of what is called DEI, so diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's a term that a lot of people use, not only in academia, but also in companies these days. A lot of DEI kind of initiatives and factors are oftentimes measured according to assessments that come out of companies. And they are oftentimes tied together to the headcounts. So for instance, the company says that we are committed to DEI. Well, let's see how many percentage, what's the percentage of your workers? How many of them come from this population, that population, that population? The problem with that it is that it doesn't really represent the true DEI. You basically are reducing people down to what is most salient about them, and then counting them as if each person basically are countable, qualifiable, when we are more than that. So the higher education DEI initiatives tend to focus on projects that basically push the policies and traditions forward, as opposed to trying to prove whether or not they are effective by counting things that is arbitrary. So that's the biggest difference between the company DEI and then kind of a higher education focus of DEI. So I fall in the latter. So your question is so appreciated, because I think a lot of people then get really frustrated these days in higher education. Also, the DEI is a fluff. It's not a fluff, because what you're trying to promote is that regardless of your differences, we all want to make sure when people come to colleges or universities, they feel like they belong. Otherwise, we can't learn, and we can learn well. So trying to promote a sense of belonging, that's my job. And sometimes it is very hard to quantify it. And so that when I'm talking to business people within the college, they get frustrated with me too.
Thank you so much.
I have a question, Dr. Sarah. So what kind of inspired you to pursue a degree in clinical psychology, and kind of what, I guess, also inspired you to work in higher education?
It's a really good, great question. I was a competitive swimmer for a long time when I was growing up. I was pretty good. Almost made it to the national team, and I wanted to study coaching. I saw growing up that United States, for instance, was one of the countries that would always dominate swimming in Olympics and world competitions and all of that. And I watched TV when I was growing up, I watched these swim meets, and realized that the relationships between coaches and athletes were very different from the relationships that we had with our coaches in Japan, which was very hierarchical, which is very much, I will tell you what to do, and we know what's best, and you basically do what we tell you to do. Your job is to swim. Whereas I saw American athletes or swimmers having this, very free conversations and very free communication with their coaches. And there were closeness between them that I did not observe in Japan. So that intrigued me so much. I wanted to become a coach. And at the time, this is back in the 80s, at the time, the best programs that would produce coaches, Olympic level coaches, were scattered around the country, one of which was one of the major initiatives was at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, which is middle of nowhere. But they were one of the first universities that started the kind of an Olympic athletes performance laboratory. And I dreamt of going there, but I spoke zero English. So I had to go to ESL school first and learn language. And then I went to Ball State and I was going to swim for them as well, except that at the time, NCAA had a very strict rules about not counting your time as official time if you didn't graduate from the NCAA approved programs, which I didn't because I was from Japan. So I swam for a good year or so on the team. Didn't matter if I finished first, my time was always unofficial. And then it just hit me one day thinking that, my gosh, just because you swim and practice every day of the rest of your life, there's no way human body will ever be able to swim 100 meter in 1 second. That will never happen. And that's when I realized, oh my gosh, compared to the human bodies, human psyche seems so limitless and so expansive. So I wanted to study psychology. And once I started studying psychology, I realized no person ever exists in their own single vacuum. We are social animals, we impact each other, and that's how our psyches change and shape. So that's why I studied both the interpersonal kind of a communication stuff as well as sociology. And that positioned me to want to go to grad school. And I first went to marriage and family therapy program, and I hated it because it was pretty clear to me that people were coming in and then you're supposed to work with them, but there are only two paths, whether or not the family stays intact or family breaks up. Those are the only two options that people oftentimes sort out. And I thought that doesn't seem creative. And, you know, it feels so limited. And that was when in one of the lectures at the time when I was in grad school, I heard about and I learned about Adler. And I kid you not, I felt as if I was struck by lightning. And it just, everything made sense to me. I wanted to learn about him. I wanted to read about him. And then I found out that there was a school dedicated to his theory. And so I had offers and acceptance from other state universities. I chose intentionally to go to Adler because I wanted to learn about him. So that's the pathway that led me to clinical psychology. And my master's degree is in counseling, but I switched over to the dark side, if you will, wanted to find out what is wrong with the person, because that truly intrigued me, because what we consider what's wrong with people are a lot more complex than we imagine. It could be the childhood, it could be the physical trauma, it could be the environment, it could be things that are predisposition to the person before they were even born. So all these things intrigued me to seek clinical psychology. And then once I graduated, I started focusing on higher education because one-on-one, that's meaningful and meaningful for so many people. But as a woman of color, I felt like there was a limitation to what I can do. I wanted to change the system and I wanted to change or impact the system that will then change different communities. So I intentionally again chose higher education and tried to tap into how I can impact, you know, systemic changes. So that's the kind of a long pathway to where I am.
Dr. Sarah, I have a question as well. By the way, hi. I'm just kind of wondering if you've encountered any ethical situations you've had to deal with in your time of practice, and how you dealt with those situations.
I think the unfortunate thing is that you will run into ethical dilemmas all the time. If you're in counseling profession, you will run into ethical dilemmas. So one of the things that I can... the dilemmas that I run into that I can share with you was when I was a... doing advanced practicum, third year, fourth year, something like that in my doctoral program, I was at this state prison system, and I was to shadow somebody who just graduated, was already a doctorate, and then was doing a postdoc. And I was assigned to shadow this man who was basically my superior, and then do rounds of inmates in the prison system. And this guy, the one that I was following after or shadowing after, was so abusive that, for instance, he would walk around with a clip of papers, and taking notes or whatever. And anytime he would ask questions, and then oftentimes they were targeted toward people of color, and in this case men of color, because I was at a men's prison. And he would ask questions, and they would answer the questions very respectfully. And it's not abuse, that like a physical abuse, but he would say things like, what did you say? I don't understand you. When I perfectly understood them, there was no issues with their grammar, there were no issues with their accent, nothing. But he kept on doing that, people after people after people, to the point that some of the inmates even apologized for no reason. And they would say, well, I'm so sorry, Dr. So-and-so, maybe I'm not speaking right. And I thought to myself, this is abusive. I mean, this is complete lack of respect for these people. For whatever the reason that they are in the prison, they don't need to be further treated like crap. And I agonized over, and then I went to the supervisor and then reported this. And the supervisor, according to the APA ethics code, which he did the excellent job, he said, as scary as it may be, you two are seen as peers. You guys are a team together, so why won't you bring this up and have a conversation with him? And if that goes south, then I got your back. And I had probably one of the most difficult conversations with this person. And years later, I found out he left psychology because his license was revoked. And what I found out was that he was doing the exact same thing, kind of thing, but it was escalating to the point that he got caught being completely unethical, actually immoral things to his clients. So that was one example that I can share with you.
I think that was, is that everybody?
I think everyone got their questions in. I really love this conversation, like hearing about your experience with inmates. And don't mind if I for sharing this, Athena, but like she's one of the one of our cohort members that wants to work in a prison. So like hearing your experience, the fact that you didn't have a negative, I'm sure you've probably had negative experiences in prison, but the fact that you had it with your peer, that's crazy. And I guess not crazy when you walk into a field like this, but wow, yeah. I think it's really interesting to hear that sort of conversation. We have been super like intrigued with working with like clients that may trigger. And one of the clients that we've actually mentioned recently was working with like pedophiles, and what that experience is like. We've talked about it, and a couple of our professors have shared their experience with it. But I wonder if you have any experiences with it, or even not just pedophiles, but maybe clients that that maybe trigger things for you and how it was for you.
So I have worked with pedophiles and sex offenders, registered sex offenders, and then some of these people were the released people from into the halfway houses. So I have worked with both men and women pedophiles and then registered sex offenders. And what I can tell you is that, you know, my great mentor, Harold Mozak, one of the founders of the Adler University, he took me in, and he had a private practice, and he had this kind of a well-known private practice on Michigan Avenue, thriving, and it's basically where people came to from all over the world when they were told by so many other people, there is no hope for you. So he had all kinds of clientele. And I asked him one day, and I was like, Dr. Mozak, I mean, you have all kinds of clients. You have kids all the way to people in the 80s, all kinds of life circumstances and issues. Are there anyone that you cannot work with because of whatever the difficulties? And he said, no, except for one. And he said, and then this is a man who practiced nearly, what, oh my gosh, 65 years. He died recently in the last 4 years or so, but up until his death into 90s, he was practicing and he was sharp as whip. And he said, there was one time that I refer a person out, and you're talking about thousands, literally thousands and thousands of clients, and just one person he referred out. And I asked him who that person was, and he said during the intake, it became very clear that this is a person who was responsible. He was the SS within a near Auschwitz camp, where half of my relatives were sent to a gas chamber. And when I found out who this person was, he said, I started shaking. I knew I wouldn't be able to be objective and then treat this person the way that he deserves. Although he said every single cell of me basically hated him. But the moment that I found out, I couldn't treat. And that was the only one person. And I took that to my heart that, you know, and he used to say, you know, unless that you have been traumatized or you have horrible, horrible experiences, simply because you have certain notions about, for instance, criminals or sex offenders or pedophiles, don't count them out. And his advice was always try it out and see whether or not it is a population that you cannot work. If you cannot work, then get out. But if you are not going to harm that person because you are, you know, wrapped up in your own stuff, try it out and see whether or not you like it. And then I took that to heart. So I have seen sex offenders, I have seen pedophiles, and the one couple, one client that during my practice I could not work with, and then I had to refer them out, was a young court order couple who came in because the court basically said to me, I need you to basically assess their competency level, and because they are caught with crime against their child. So they came in, normal looking people, and they sat down across from me. They had a newborn baby. And because the newborn baby cries so much, which newborn babies do, it's a natural thing. They pick up the baby and then bash the baby against the microwave, the corner of the microwave, to the point that the skull indentation and damages were so severe that this baby would never ever be able to walk, talk, or see. And when I found out about the nature of the crime and the fact that those two human beings across from me had zero remorse, and they were laughing about it, zero remorse, I knew then I cannot work with people who intentionally take away potentials from human beings. That I cannot do. So it's not the pedophile or sex offenders neatly compartmentalized in a categorical format. It's who they are that I cannot work with. It's not the title or definition or description of people. It's what they do that I cannot work with.
I would say I really love that you said that, because even getting into this, there's things that I said, like, there's things that I wouldn't do. Like, you know, I always told myself I could never work with a racist person until I took your class. And I started to understand the significance of it. So, and then I always think like, oh, I can never work with like a pedophile or a sex offender. But saying that, I said it in class, like hurt people. So it is a good understanding to see what is the root of that, like what happened in your life to make you feel like this is okay or that was okay. So I'm glad that you said that. So thank you very much for that, Dr. Sarah. I also wanted to say, like, some of us are starting practicums pretty soon, or some of us have already started our practicum. So what type of advice would you give us as we go into this field and actually start to be hands-on? For example, like me and Athena and Janelle, we're currently working at the Riverside Free Clinic, and like the next week we're going to be like, they want us to start being hands-on, like doing our own clients. And so like, I'm really nervous about it. So what advice would you give to us who have already started and are about to start our practicums